Yeah, well, just tell me how you start, how you...
Oh, we were talking about the prairie up on the ridge.
Right.
And they were going to develop it, and they wanted to put a road through that area.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, they could have the prairie plants in the road. They could tear that up anyway. So they find out about where that road goes through there. And we could dig out whatever we wanted to there. Dug into it, boy, the whole thing was just glacial moraine, boulders, mostly 2-4 inches
yeah.
diameter. Boy, it's hard digging. They're pretty good prairie plants, quite a bit of it. But you sure couldn't get very deep in that is sandy, rocky soil.
Mm.
And instead of having great big clumps like we'd hoped, you just had little handfuls of sods. About all you could get to stay together in that gravelly soil
mm.
they had there. And that gravel's also hard to dig in. But we managed to dig it out and bring it in. And since it was a upland dry type, we started over there next to the, what's the name of that woods down there?
Noe
Woods, yeah. And that was the highest, driest part, and so we planned along on that slope. Longley could originally draw on his prairie map, so as to go up to the Noe Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And then had sort of narrow tongue there, and widened out as it got to here, mm-hmm. and then the Leopold Pines were going in just to the south of it. And they were already planting the pines in there at that time. So I took that part, which was designated as prairie, and put my plants all along there. And it turned out...
You brought them back in trucks?
Yeah. I would bring a truckload of time. I have, I suppose, 5 tons, some sort of gravel, rock, and sod.
Drive up in the morning, back in the evening,
that's
and then
right.
plant the next day, or how did you...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'd stay there until we got truckload. If we got less than a day, we'd bring it back. But actually, it was about an all-day trip. We took lunch along, dug it up there. And then we'd plant them out in that spot the next day and just dig holes in the sod and put them in there.
How did we
started out in, April? Late April.
What kind of people were the enrollees you were working with? Remember any of their attitudes or anecdotes from the work?
No, just a general mixture of kids that weren't too well trained and out of work or need something to do,
mm-hmm.
and the CCC program was just a make work program,
mm-hmm.
But they did. He was mostly the young fellows, all the way from 18 to 23, 25, something sort. And the arrangement was that the actual feeding, housing, and general care of the enrollees was up to the Army. And the Army would turn over most of the men to the project superintendent. At 8 o'clock in the morning, and then we'd come on back 4:35 and turn them back to the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So the Army had the responsibility all the time, except when they're out on the job working.
Do you remember any experiences connected with collecting those plants that were exciting or interesting?
Not particularly. Most of the fellows just did what they're told to do, and they wanted to dig up rocks and. Boulders, soil, and things of that sort, okay. Some of them didn't care much for it, but the Army says if they're growling about it, well, they're okay.
If they what?
If they're growling about it, well, they're okay.
Oh, I see.
if they stop growling, then you sort of get uncertain.
Yeah.
Good old Army philosophy.
Mm. Say, should I could get you a... So this wasn't a particularly colorful bunch of people.
Oh, no. It was just some worker that sort of took the gang over with one of them, showed some interest and aptitude. He's our straw boss, help out.
Mm-hmm.
And had somebody who was one of the enrollees themselves to sort of look after the rest of them, so as to divide their responsibility, and so it wouldn't all be Parks Forest versus the enrollees. But the enrollees have, if they have their own straw boss, why they work together a little bit better.
What kind of work was that? Hard work? Drudgery? Grueling?
I wasn't a slave driver at all. Kept at it, but we tried to keep a little conversation going, and I talked a little bit about the plants we were digging up and things of sort, what we wanted to do. There wasn't any animosity among the group at all. Just the general chatter while they were working. Mm-hmm. And then we got here, and the next day we go out there and dig holes in the ground there and put them in. And I had most of the job of just seeing if they did it right. I'd show them how I wanted it done. And see if they do it right. And if I didn't have anything else to do, of course, I'd help plant along with the rest of them.
What was your attitude about the significance of this work?
If we could get the plants to grow, whether it develop as a prairie or not, I had my fingers crossed on that. I didn't know just what to expect. I knew what I'd sort of like to have, but whether it ever materialized or not. And of course, we ran into that dry weather a month later, and the chance of getting them to grow in that dry weather was not at all good. And they began watering all the trees and shrubs that had been planting. The other crews had been planting on the other projects, and they needed the water worse than my prairie plants did, because prairie plants knew what to do with dry weather. And the other trees, they didn't.
Yeah. Well, tell me about that watering brigade that you had going there.
Well, the only way they had for it was to get the water out of the lake. They had a flatbed truck and got a big bunch of oil drums and tops out and drive it down to the edge of the lake and take the water out of the lake and dump it in the drum and drive it back over the rough trails, and the truck would wobble back and forth, and water would splash, splash, splash. And you felt lucky to get the barrel more than half full by the time you got back. And then you'd dip it out of the barrel and pour it on the plant.
Where did you get that from the lake? Where did you drive down to the lake?
About halfway down there someplace.
If I recall, go down right on here or someplace.
Okay, just about midway on the south shore of the lake.
So they had this road in the through over here already at that time.
Right.
And they wanted to, well, they didn't have too far to go from the road off to the lake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the spot was hardly solid enough ground for us to
have some kind of footing for the truck.
Right.
And down just the other end, where that brown is there, why, that is too marshy.
They need that. Yeah, it's too wet down here.
Yeah, well, it's too wet up here, too.
Yeah.
Less, probably right down about in here.
Yeah.
Where the higher ground comes down.
Right across from Baldwin Street there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember just where.
Mm-hmm.
But someplace where you didn't have to drive over any marsh to get to it.
Right.
And it had high ground right down close to the lake itself.
Will those guys climb right down in the lake and dip water out?
One of them would, some would be dipping. A few days later, a day or two of that is pretty slow. But they got a little pump. Gasoline pump,
oh, yeah.
And would pump it up into the barrels.
Yeah, yeah.
had the job trying to keep the doggone motor going. But it did work better there.
Hot weather.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that drought continued, got just day after week after week, and 100-degree temperature, and we just weren't getting, we couldn't haul enough water to do it all very good. They put on two shifts, started early in the morning, worked up until sunset, two different shifts. Then they still weren't keeping up, so they had three shifts, 24 hours a day. The night shift would work on the plants closer to the road.
So they'd be driving back and forth all night there that time?
Yeah. And divide the whole crew into three shifts to keep one crew going all day, all night.
That must have been uncomfortable work and spending time, nights in the camp and everything. It must have been unpleasant, huh?
Well, they stay at the camp anyway.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, in such hot weather, I mean.
Oh, well, yeah, the night shift had the lucky ones. They could work in cooler weather.
Yeah.
In the afternoon shift, it really had the rough going.
Yeah.
When the temperatures were really high.
How'd they break up those shifts? Noon to 8?
I don't remember. Yeah. I remember all the three shifts. The prairie group, we didn't try to do any night watering on the prairie.
Mm-hmm.
The prairie group just got whatever surplus we could get, because the horticulturals had definite priority, and then the forest tree plantings are next. And if there's any work left over, well, we could get whatever we could on it, but we didn't have a lot of. But we did try it on some of the prairie plants. I had the spots there, and I didn't want the kids trampling on the plants there, and I tried to work around the spots. But they couldn't be bothered. That is work enough to carry the water out and pour it on the spots, and having to try to avoid the spots, try to even see where they were. They weren't very good. As I said, my notes suspect maybe the trampling of spots did about damage to the plants is the lack of water.
Yeah.
And that watering, the plants need the water, no doubt about that. But watering spots on the soil. Now, the trees and shrubs, you could see where they were there. But they couldn't tell one plant from another.
Yeah.
As far as they're concerned, they're all weeds.
Why did you choose the technique of planting single species stands the way you did?
That's a good question. I don't know. I suppose that's primarily what we had to start with. The upland ridge plants that we got first, that only lasted two or three weeks, and the road spot played out. I suppose we hauled a total of maybe 8 or 10 loads. But we planted there those upland species, Anthropogon scoparius was the principal one, but they're a lead plant and Baptisia and some others that were also in there, and we planted whatever was there. Mostly the Anthropogon scoparius that grew originally, maybe a few of the others. But as I said, that fall, when I made a check after the fall rains did arrive, there was about 8% of them or something sort that apparently had a spot of the spots that had plants growing on.
8%?
Mm-hmm. The rest didn't show anything. Then after rather hard winter and that growth start in the spring, I got made a resurvey of the same plant again. In that same north area, and I mean west area, and only about 3% of them came up the next spring.
3%.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Discouraging start.
Yeah, quite.
How did you feel at that point?
Well, that's what happens when you get dry weather.
Yeah, you'd have to figure that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
had you worked with a crew all summer on the prairie?
Yeah, we started in and including the watering, worked up until frost.
Crew, how large a crew?
Usually be about, from 7 or 8 up to 12, 15.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Because they had about 200 in the camp.
Yeah.
And they were running all kinds of projects. The tree planting took a crew and they had the drag line out doing some pond digging.
Yeah.
And had to put a road in someplace. I didn't have anything to do with the other projects. Harold Madden was the one who directed the crews on the various projects. And of course, Madden did what Longneck suggested he does. Longneck are the one that assigned priorities. And Madden transferred the priority over to the various crews. And the various crews were under the the management of the crew foremen, which were not who were not the CCC employees at all. The crew foremen were actually employees of the National Park Service. There was picked especially to look after the CCC crews, and I was one of the crew foremen.
Three 3% survived after the first winter.
Yeah, but I figured that we could probably do better than that. Now, afterwards, I think possibly, I'm pretty sure it was, the same season toward the middle of summer, late in the summer, they found a spot over in here someplace, I don't remember where, it was the Blue Stem Prairie. And
over to the east here.
Over to the east here someplace. And we went in there and dug up that, and that came up, and there was no rocky soil, it was clay soil, and came up in big chunks, 8, 10, 12 inches in diameter. They got 12 inches, they were pretty heavy to handle, but 8, 10 inches, so they could handle that. And we couldn't put nearly as much on that, as many clumps on a truckload, but they weighed as much.
Yeah.
But actually, it's considerably easier to handle.
And grow better.
Probably. Oh, yeah. And that, we knew, went on much lower soil. And so I came this side of the prairie and over near the corner of the golf course, out on that low soil and picked a spot there. Now, close to the road, as we thought the prairie was going to stand, looking at Longneck's map, and started along the border and worked on back. That's what I was doing this afternoon just before I came in. As to the first of that bottom prairie, the big blue stem and sargastrum, was some we planted along just off the corner of the golf course there. And that's what I got lost in. That stuff is up there 8-10 feet high. Some of the heaviest stuff you have on the whole arboretum. And so that was the first planting we did on the low ground, as a contrast to that upland prairie we had back there in the woods. And that is beautiful prairie. But beautiful as far as the cover of grass is concerned. It had surprisingly a few forbs in it. It was just plain turkeyfoot, blue stem, and sargastrum. And that's all it was there. A few woolen rods, and I have a notes here someplace that what else I found there. That is very little. I think it's right over here. Now, I said solid andropogon and sargastrum. 7 feet tall, solid, and then it mixed in with them just a little bit of the solid ego candensis, and a little wild rose in there, and a little sunflower, Baptisia to a few Monarda, but they're just scattered plants.
I mean, that's the results now.
That's what I found today,
yeah.
This afternoon.
50 years later. 50 odd years later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be about 54 years.
Right.
Down there.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
From the time these put in. And these other plants, other than the grass, were just little patches, spots, or individual plants.
So some things have spread in there since then.
Well, yeah, I suppose those did spread in. By the way, one of the problems you have is the cornice, dogwood.
Mm-hmm.
And you have lots of that in the prairie.
Yeah.
It's not hurting anything, but it's there.
Yeah. We've got some shrub problems out there.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the cornice because it's common all over the prairie,
mm-hmm.
everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not bothering any. It's a little low stuff. Apparently the fire
yeah.
keeps it cleared on the ground.
Yeah.
And it only grows a few inches, several inches tall, mostly.
Yeah.
And it doesn't dominate, or it doesn't appear to dominate any other prairie plants at all. It's present.
Yeah.
How, if it does have an effect, I don't know what it is. I don't see it.
Doesn't seem to seed much.
Hmm?
Doesn't seem to fruit much.
No. Just occasionally I find a little fruit, but not very much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And those are usually a border. That's where you get the fruit. But there's almost no fruit, cornice fruit out there. It needs to survive more than 1 year to fruit much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And most of this is just the 1 year's growth. Apparently the roots stay alive.
Right.
Rhizomes.
It works like the oaks, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you continued through the next 3 or 4 years, through 1940,
yeah.
Planting these little plots.
Yeah.
Now you told me at one time, Ted, I want to verify this, one of the reasons you planted the little single species plots was because it was easier to supervise the crew that way.
Oh, a bit, yeah. We didn't do much seed planting the first year. It was just a sod planting. And then we started collecting seed that fall, but I decided not to try putting it in, so we just held the seed over winter and put in seed spots. And there, of course, the crews came in with a mattock and scalped the old field growth, pasture growth,
mm-hmm.
or the cornfield growth, which are mostly quack grass and bluegrass,
mm-hmm.
which had come in after the farm had been discontinued. And we just scalped the top of it off, and then it took the long handled shovel and turned it over, broke it up a little bit. But the quack grass especially has very heavy rhizomes, and we get in there, break it up, and pull out those rhizomes. The bluegrass, the rhizomes are very thin, top, and you skim them off the top, no problem. But the rhizomes of the quack grass are deep.
You're talking about planting seed now with those?
Yeah,
those spots.
And well, we took pull the rhizomes out, and then broke it up and put the seeds in there. And I had the fellows putting these spots in about a meter apart, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
And I did practically all the seed planting myself.
Mm-hmm. From the seed you'd gathered the year before?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How did that work out then?
And it worked out very well.
Really?
As a matter of fact, the seed spots were considerably easier, and got a little more coverage from the work we put in than we did with the sod. The sod was not only big and heavy in the first place, but there wasn't a great deal of it in the first place. It wasn't available.
Yeah.
And we could get more seed along the railroad. I think that's right. Occasionally, we'd have enough seed from one particular patch of railroad I could take crew 3 or 4 out and gather. But often I did it myself.
So you're out gathering seed with... Would you like this closer?
No, that's right.
So you were out gathering seed with these guys?
Occasionally.
Mm-hmm. Did they enjoy that?
One or two of them didn't. I picked those who showed more interest in it, more cooperative. And yeah, they were okay. Mm-hmm.
You planted those seeds what time of the year?
Well, if I got them in the spring or summer, I'd plant them within a week or two, right away. But if it was too late in the fall, I'd hold them over winter. We had a little shed. I've forgotten what it'd been used for. But we moved it out here just off the edge of the camp, near the edge of where the prairie would be. And we kept our shovels and mattocks in there. And I had some shells built up there, and I filled the shells up with a lot of packets and seeds, different species of seeds, different packets. And I'd get a packet here and sow that bunch, and I'd get another packet and sow that bunch. And I'd have 30, 40, 50 packets, different kinds of seeds, or even of the same kind, collected at a different place or under different circumstances.
And of course, that's all recorded in your notes.
Mm-hmm.
So as the project went on, did you go more away from planting sods and more toward
sod? We planted sod when we had it. If we could get some, I would do it. And we tried on the big silphiums and a few of the other plants where we didn't have a sod, but we could dig up the individual plants. Silphiums have the big roots. And you could dig those up and just put them in individual individual plantings. And one thing that I've been discovering on the last two or three days is those transplants, silphium, don't survive. Now, you put the seeds in, they come up beautifully. We got lots of silphium all over the place. But they might transplants, those places are empty.
Is that right?
Yeah, silphiums aren't there. And we established a prairie out there, just off the edge of the golf course. I mean a prairie nursery. And I grew some in there. I put some of the seeds in the nursery and let them grow up. And then you can take the plants that grew in the nursery, and they did grow pretty well in the nursery, and then transplant them out in the prairie. Well, the transplants didn't survive. So the wild plants from the wild that we pulled in there didn't survive, and the nursery plants didn't survive. But if you put them in seed spots, well, they grew well.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. In fact, I don't know what the reason is.
Tell me about living in the camp here. You were separate from your wife the whole time.
Yeah. Except for this, we go back and forth. During the summers, when she wasn't teaching, we got a little cabin over here on the south side of Lake Monona. And drove back and forth.
You had a car?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had the car all along, but she kept the car down in Decatur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you didn't need it up here.
Yeah.
Did
and
you?
And she, I'd go down there sometimes if we had an extra long weekend, but just by train. Or if she had a holiday or during summer, she drove up here.
Yeah.
But she had a Christmas holiday and tried driving up here. And about halfway up, two-thirds way up Illinois, ran into an ice storm and ran the car on the ditch, and she had one heck of a time getting to Madison. She didn't like coming in Madison in the winter at all.
So, but you did have Christmas here then?
Yeah.
Where did you stay when she was here? Did she stay at the camp?
No, we got a room here someplace in the area.
Yeah.
Stayed at the room. Like a tourist room. It wasn't very much tourist business in the winter.
Yeah.
But we found a tourist room.
What was your wife's name?
Gladys. No, let me correct that. Gladys C. Gallagher.
Mm-hmm.
She never adopted the name Sperry.
Oh, really?
That's right.
She kind of a modern woman.
She had her own doctorate degree, and she didn't want to be a sidekick of somebody else.
Yeah.
She had her own. She was a very remarkable gal. Very remarkable.
Really?
And she's independent. I encouraged her right from the very first to keep her own name. And so she's Dr. Gallagher
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Sperry.
Did Did she teach her whole career?
Hmm?
Did she teach her whole career?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She taught there at Millikan for quite a number of years. Until about 55 or sometime. But she finally got tired of that. And, I remember 1951. Because 1951, I got a leave. For other details. No, it was in graduate school. No, it wasn't graduate school either. I was fun teaching. Started my teaching in 1946 as at Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1951, I got the request for a consultant for a project in Africa. And during the time that I was in Africa, I took my classes there at Pittsburgh, Kansas.
Oh.
Yeah. She came over.
Yeah.
And when she came over to do the teaching there, the president we had at that time, that's another thing. We were already a little concerned about the trend of population programs. We didn't want any.
Oh, really? Tell me a little bit about life in the camp here, Ted. Did you enjoy living out here?
Oh, I it's about like living in the Army. No, you don't live as there are a few guys that can live in camp life, Army life, and get along very well. But most of us put up with it.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
Do you ever have any Army experience?
No.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
No.
You just put up with it. It's all right. Nothing to brag about.
Were there any little incidents in camp life that would be interesting to know about?
I was pretty much then, as I am now, interested in my own particular projects, and I don't socialize too extensively with the others.
Mm-hmm.
And I much rather take care of my own interests. And I go around to some social affairs from time to time, but mostly I go off and get the things done that I want to get done. I think more important than.
Did you tell me about the time when some guys bet that they could get away from a bulldozer?
I wrote that up in one of the articles.
Tell me that story.
That was among some of the other. A camp foreman, Park Service foreman. Lee Cutler was a bulldozer operator. And Paul Mazaros was a tool man. And Lee Cutler is quite a sociable kind of guy. A hail fellow well met and always kidding around with the rest of them. And Paul said something about his big old lumbering Caterpillar tractor and says, "Don't you deride that Caterpillar, it's a doggone good machine." I said, "Well, it's sort of a lumbering elephant." I said, "You just try and get away from the elephant, see how well you do." He said, Paul said, "I can out-dodge that thing anyway, nimble enough that you can't turn around fast enough." Lee challenged him to get away from the bulldozer. Now, they did admit that if they were going down the road, Paul could run faster and the Caterpillar could go for about the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But when it came to endurance, the Caterpillar keep on going and Paul, but they agreed that since it wasn't a matter of the speed down the road, but there's maneuverability, And they picked a spot just outside the window here, which is going to be someday prairie planting or other shrub planting in there. But they wouldn't be getting to the planting area for 2 or 3 years. And so they'd stay right within that field. Lee had his caterpillar on one edge of the field, and Paul could take any place he wanted to, and he got away from me. And so I took the caterpillar there. And what Paul hadn't realized was the caterpillars are hinged right in the middle. If one run one track and not the other one, and can turn around and right within half its own length. And as soon as Paul dodged one side, Lee was right there after him. And that contest lasted only about 3 minutes. Bing! No way! Paul could see he's going to get run over. Doesn't matter which way he turned. Not a chance.
You remember the night the building burned down here?
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Nobody knew, as far as I know. A leak in the chimney or something sort.
Yeah.
Long about the middle of the night or early in the morning, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I guess.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Someone told me that they moved a pool table out of that building.
After the fire started?
Yeah.
I suppose it did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. About the only thing is could salvage out of it. They set up a tent here and it's had a mess tent.
Was the food all right here?
Oh, God, old army food.
Yeah.
The army food, if they have anybody saying good, is always all right. Nothing to brag about, but it's certainly nutritious.
Yeah.
And entirely edible. And if you got a crew that's hungry and been working, they'll eat almost anything because they're ready for food.
Tell me how your experience at the camp here came to an end.
It was simple enough. They had selective service. Everybody had to register. And they had their big lottery and pulled the numbers out of the goldfish bowl in Washington, D.C. And that was a big news item at the time. They reached in there and pulled out a capsule and they read it off, the number on the in the capsule, and write it down and reach in there and pull out the next one, mix them up every so often, pull them out. So the sequence of the numbers was the order in which they were called up. And I wasn't the first, but I was among the early ones drawn. And we were called up for service before the war started. Organized, and I got my draft notice.
When was that?
1941.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back just a second. Tell me about, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the results of the prairie work, the weed problems. How did once the prairie plants started growing, what was the situation? How did the prairie look?
Pretty sad.
Yeah.
Just plants here and there, and that notebook I'm telling about shows my survey during those years, whether that particular planting was going and whether another one was not. That was one of the advantages of planting individual plantings of the same species, as you had the outline and the plantings all within the outline. You could count each spot and you knew they were all everything that spot and how many of them were developing and how it didn't, how many did not. And so we could get percentages of germination. Now if you had mixed planting, as Curtis later recommended after I left, there's no way of telling which species came through in good order and which were in poor.
Right.
You got a good mixture when they did come up, but no way of keeping track of it.
Yeah.
And I sort of figured that at the time I put it in. I wanted to see which of these were growing, which was not. And as I pointed out, sometimes if you transplant them, they grew, but if you put the seed in, they didn't very well. Or if the seed grew, but the transplants wouldn't.
Yeah.
Well, I had my numbering system was each species had its own number. But the series with the seed plants, the seed spots, were a different series than those which were transplants. And so I'd have sometimes two numbers for Petalospora and Purpureum, mm-hmm. those which are put in seed and the series that put in transplants.
Mm-hmm. Right. Did you, when you saw a lot of weeds coming in, how did you?
Ordinarily, I didn't bother too much then. The plants have to grow with a lot of competition anyway, and there wasn't much of any way of taking weeds out. And when the seedling come up, weren't too sure of which were the plants put in there, we just let them go.
Did you wonder whether the prairie plants were going to make it?
Sure.
The weeds, I mean.
I wasn't too much worried about it. I figured the prairie plants probably could out endure the weeds any day of the week.
You figured that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Weeds are ephemerals.
Well, when did you start thinking about fire?
We weren't even thinking about fire because the area was very much trampled where we'd been doing the seed spots. And there was just some growth of grass. There are a few persons who were a little concerned about crack grass getting back in there, but the seed spots where the rhizome has been pulled out had maintained the plants well enough, allowed them to grow well enough, so that they weren't too much crowded. But we didn't have enough vegetation over the surface to do any burning at all until about the third or fourth year. By that time, then the plants were growing up all around them. And sure enough, their grasses, weed grasses, were fairly abundant around them. But you could still look in among them and see the individual spots easily.
Had you been planning to burn all along?
Or no.
How did that come up?
Because we could see the weeds were getting pretty heavy there, and noted that the plants in the heavy weeds weren't flowering quite as well as some of the rest of it. And we did know that the management of prairie pastures were improved by burning. The ranchers had been burning for years. And so we knew that ranch grazers did burn, and we figured maybe the burning would help. Well, I said, okay, we'll try it. See, remember, that was in Smoky Bear days.
That's right.
It prevent forest fires. And there's a big emphasis countrywide against burning natural areas. And we figured if it wasn't any good to burn a forest, why you shouldn't burn the prairie either. But I did say, when we suggested putting a fire on it, we'll try it and see. We had a patch out here, not too far out from here, that had pretty good growth. It'd been put in two or three years earlier, some of the earlier, and it had pretty good growth on it. It's where I planted the prairie plants.
Mm-hmm.
And the growth was the prairie plants and the weeds, the prairie plants and the weeds around them both. And there are two or three planting. I remember our elytras was one of them. I've forgotten what some of the other plants were. And we went across two or three of the plantings. I just drew a line there. And we burned everything that was within those lines. And we had the next line, and this we didn't burn in control. And another patch where the prairie planting has been made, a strip through there, and then a control strip. And so we burned two strips across the patch and had the unburned control. And by June 1st of July, Hey, the burn strip's showing beautiful nitrous and some of the other plants growing nicely. And the unburned strips were having a tough time surviving. Being, it looked like fires were definitely a bit of a benefit. I suppose somebody has photographs of that. I don't remember whether they do or not.
Who inaugurated those fires?
That was my idea.
That was your idea?
Yeah. Of burning the strips. I don't remember who had suggested it was burn it. I was the one that set up the experiment.
You burned it with the CCC boys?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't remember who suggested that?
No. But we've been talking about it for some time.
We? Who's we?
Me and I suppose Longnecker and maybe Passa. I don't remember who else were in on. And there's quite a bit of criticism against doing any burning at all. It's called the Smoky Bear effect.
Criticism from whom?
Persons who, I couldn't say who, knew about the burning process and wondered whether it'd be any good or not.
You get calls?
No, just local. Conversation. Nobody on the outside. Maybe somebody on the committee who learned we were going to burn, maybe have brought a call in, but not very much. But it was just a small patch and didn't have too much effect.
Now, you're saying you did this because of the experience of farmers and ranchers managing?
That was the reason I agreed to have that fire strips across there and laid out the experiment for it.
Yeah.
That was in 1940, I think.
1940?
Yeah.
The last year you were here?
Last year. Mm-hmm. Last year. And so I left the next year before we'd done much planning and before there had been much growth.
Yeah.
I planted all. So,
Were you thinking of the old prairie fires of pre-settlement times when you did that at all?
We knew they occurred, and we didn't know whether that improved the prairie or not.
Yeah.
We did know the prairie grew in spite of the prairie fires.
Yeah. So when you got the result, that must have been kind of interesting.
It was. And we would have followed up next year, but Uncle Sam beat us to it, and everything closed down, bang.
Yeah.
Nothing done.
So we
didn't know anything about further until close to the end of the war, when Curtis came in. Curtis had been here at the university all the time, and he showed interest. He finally had his Vegetation Wisconsin book published.
Did you work with Curtis when you were here at all?
I knew about him. No, when I was here, he was still trying to grow orchids from seed. As his project. And he didn't, he got out the arboretum here once or twice, but didn't show too much interest in it. It was not until after the war that I wasn't around, they were talking about getting the arboretum going again, that he began showing up, and he wanted to follow through on that fire deal. And so he ran a series of experiments with fire on the prairie, and they were controlled in large enough areas. So he was the one that wrote up the effect of fire and had the data to support it. My two little strips I'd burned in 1940 were not enough of a control to prove anything. And he needed far more than just that, and he got it. So his work, as far as I know, was the pioneering in use of fire. And he's been given credit, and I give him credit for showing that the fire is definitely beneficial.
Mm-hmm. What time of year did you do your burn?
I did about March, as soon as the soil dried off enough to burn, before the growth had started appreciably.
Yeah.
When there hadn't been any growth yet. And it was during the summer, that summer in 1940.
That was on Curtis Prairie?
Hmm?
That was on Curtis Prairie?
Oh, yeah, right out here.
Yeah.
Just more than 100 yards from here.
Just south of the building here, huh?
So I forgot just where it was. I probably have some piece of my notes, a map showing just where I put it. But it was right out in this area, south of the building, where he'd put in quite a number of prairie plantings.
Ted, tell me just a little bit again.
I will say, I think I was the one that first showed the effect, the beneficial effect of fire on planted prairie.
Yeah.
But it was not enough to publish a paper on.
Right.
It'd take more than what I think Curtis did to work on it.
How did you feel at the time we were working on this project about its significance for conservation?
We just hoped it'd work. What we wanted at that time was just an example of what the prairies are like. Well, there weren't any around to speak of.
Right.
There were some old mowed pastures. I mean, mowed fields and pasture fields that had been prairie. But they're still maintained commercially for the hay or for cattle feed.
Right.
And none of them had ever been set aside, as far as I know, as a prairie. Now, they were established in some forest areas, but I don't know of any established grassland areas.
Did you think that maybe this would turn into a way of getting the prairies back?
Possibly. Well, in fact, that was the idea. You got a piece of prairie back if you're going to restore an arboretum with the various forest types, so you have a prairie type too. And yes, we wanted to establish prairie here.
How much interest was there on the part of people like Fassett and Leopold in the process of restoring the prairie?
Leopold, as far as I know, was the only one that really had a scientific interest in it. Fassett wasn't opposed to it, and Fassett did establish some little plots out here, planting plots, primarily to see what would grow, not as far as management was concerned. Fassett didn't oppose the burning. In fact, he approved it as worth doing. And I think Fassett was here at the time that the burning was done.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. He may have been, I'm not sure. But he knew about it at least, and saw their effect. But mostly Fassett and Longacre, especially Longacre, go along with whatever Leopold suggested. Leopold was, as I saw it, the way I figured, he's the brains behind it. He is a good scientist.
Did he come out and talk to you, work with you on
the
prairie?
Oh, yeah. Not work with me. I don't think he ever turned over a single shovel full of earth.
Did he discuss what was going on?
Yeah. He'd come out once every week or two and see what was going on. He kept an interest in it all.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had any suggestions to make, he'd be more apt to make a suggestion than anybody else. I say that this was done under Leopold's supervision.
What kind of suggestions would he be likely to make?
Mostly, go ahead, you're doing fine.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Just a second.
He didn't have any reason to make further comments.
Ted, I'd like to finish up this little bit of tape by asking you to tell me a little bit about your career after you left here. You were in the Army in England, and you were in Africa and Pittsburgh.
In England was from 41 to 45.
What were you doing then?
I went to basic training down in Camp Walters in Texas. And then they had that deal about the married people, the married men that shouldn't be engaged in military work when we were not at war that time. We did have to go through our basic training. The basic training, I was dismissed from the Army because we weren't at war, and I was sort of looking around for a job. Yeah, I came back here. And was
Madison?
Yeah. Because I wanted to see what was going on the prairie work here.
What time of year was that?
This is in April, the furthest.
Of 41.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because I was out someplace on the prairie, as I recall. All day Sunday, April 7th, I didn't know anything about the Japanese attack.
December 7th.
December. That's right.
You were where?
No, beg your pardon. No, that was not here. I was...
But you were in camp then?
I had been dismissed from the Army. Sort of a reprieve. As dismissed until action started. And after the attack, then I got back into the Army again.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
You missed Pearl Harbor?
Yeah.
Where were you? At that?
I was out in the field.
Where?
Hiking around wherever I was at the time. Yeah. And I don't remember right now.
Probably in Illinois.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was in the field all day. I didn't know anything about it until the next day. Anyway, when I went back in, I figured I wanted to... Well, I actually prefer the Air Force rather than the Army. I suppose I was interested in it. And primarily I was interested in the weather. And so I got back in the Air Force and I applied for weather right away. And they put me in the general draft pool. And during the interview, they wanted to place me, they suggested I be a tail gunner, because I'm just a little guy. And they want the little guys for the tail gunning position, and I'm with room to move around back the tail,
yeah,
as the old B-17s. But I didn't like the idea at all. But I would go in the weather. And I said, well, we don't have very much call for weather. anyway, have to have a heck of a big, high GCT, general test score, for weather. What is your GCT? I said, gosh, I don't remember. I'd taken the test. He said, never mind, I can find out. And he called up their test office and asked me what my GCT was. They held on the phone for 20 minutes while I was looking up. Said, oh, what? How high did it go anyway? He said, no question about what you can do. You qualified for weather. He said, you're the first person I've ever had, this is the officer who's charged with, who had a higher test score than he had.
Better watch out. So you got into meteorology.
Yeah.
For the Air Force.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they sent me to weather school. I went through the weather observer, and then they, as soon as I got out of weather observer course, well, they put me in the instructor.
Yeah.
And this is at Rantoul Field in Illinois.
Rantoul?
Rantoul. Or whatever the field was at Rantoul. I forgot the name of it.
Rantoul.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they had a big weather school there, various aviation activities, but the weather school was an important part of it. And I had a colonel in charge of the school. They had some visiting general coming around to inspect things, and they gave special instructions to have the school working perfectly. Just if the general didn't show up right away, well, I'd just keep classes going anyway. And they had already put me in charge of the teaching the meteorology for the school. And I could see that the general wasn't showing up. I told the instructor, I said, I'm supposed to take this bunch of students next, and you're supposed to hold on to them until the general comes around, but there's no sign of the general any place around. So let's try to skip the regulations and turn this bunch loose and have them their short break, not a 10-minute break, but just a little short break, and come on back into my class. The other instructor was tickled pink because he didn't want to have a gang in there where the general was coming around anyway. And so he turned that bunch loose. The rest of the classes kept going. So we turned that bunch loose, told them, now just keep quiet and don't make any fuss in the halls, and come right back here with 3, 4, 5 minutes, and we'll start right in. So to get this class going, rather than staying in the other class the whole time. The guy said, fine, I'll do it that way. So they came back into the room I was taking, and I had my lesson all worked out. It was a rather technical aspect. I forgot just what it was, something rather technical in meteorology. And I got started teaching them. Sure enough, that's when the general showed up. And by that time, the other classes are getting so restless, and some of them are being turned loose. They didn't know what to do with all that time. And here my class was going perfectly. They're all back in there. And the colonel was tickled pink. At least one class was going well. And the general came in, and I was going right through the lesson. I had the attention of the class. So I had a good lesson, a good class, and I was doing a good job presentation. The colonel was impressed. So was the general, I suppose. I don't know. And from then on, the colonel knew who I was. I had the rank of PFC.
Who was the general?
I don't know. No. I haven't talked to you.
But now, this time you were in Illinois.
Yeah.
How did you wind up in England, and what were you doing?
Oh, well, I'd put in my application for weather forecaster. They have two sections, the weather observer. Mm-hmm. This is a weather observing class. And then application for weather forecaster. And so the next call for forecasters came up. I was right on the top of this and went on to Miami, Florida, where the weather forecaster school was. Went through weather forecaster and got my, from weather forecaster. Then I went into Army, what do I call it? Officer Training Corps, mm-hmm. Officer Training School. Went in there and got my commission. And then I was assigned down to Biloxi, Mississippi for my first assignment. Then the call came up to a bunch of officers over in England. I was in on a shipment.
Shipped over there?
Yeah.
When?
This is about 43, I suppose, by this time.
Where were you stationed there?
England. Third Eye, England. They had
bases. Third Eye?
Mm-hmm. It was in the Midlands there. Mm-hmm. Had bases all over England. They could be placed. Part of them were RAF bases and part of them Army Air Force bases.
So you were helping with weather forecasts?
I was a weather officer for the Air Force.
You were providing advice?